The last case for our argument this morning is Daniel Mahoney, appellant versus Arnoldese, Appellees, and others. For the appellant Mahoney, we have Mr. Stan Anker, an attorney from Rapid City, and Brian Hutzman represents Rock Creek, which is also an appellant, if I'm getting the parties correct. Is that right, gentlemen? All right, and you'll each be speaking for 10 minutes. Okay, and I'd been told at one point Mr. Hurley would be present, but I don't see him at council table. Oh, he's back there, okay.
I'm not speaking, Your Honor.
All right, that's fine. Your appearance will be noted. And then we have Mr. Rob Schaub for the Appellees, Arnoldese, correct? Very well. All right. Also, I should note for the record that Justice Conan Camp has disqualified himself, and the court is delighted to have the return of an old friend, Justice Richard Sabers, once again sit with us. With that, Mr. Hutzman, you may proceed, and you have 10 minutes.
Good morning, Justices. There's two issues that I want to discuss in my portion of this opening portion of the oral argument. Attorney Anker will argue the balance of the issues we both have briefed. The first issue I want to discuss is fraud, and I think the case can start there and end there. There's been no fraud from a factual standpoint. The case law is clear that a fraud questions are typically questions determined by a jury. There's 10 instances in which this court has struck down a case where summary judgment on a fraud issue is granted to a plaintiff. There's one case where the Supreme Court affirmed summary judgment being granted to a plaintiff on fraud issues, and in that case, a POA used his power of attorney inappropriately, and the statute specifically says self-dealings violation of the listed statutes is fraud. So here we have a statute that says that actual fraud is always a question of fact. The court cited that statute in determining that the judgments that Daniel Mahoney used to redeem the Kenkum crippling judgments were void. The court did not hold any sort of evidentiary hearing. The court did not even allow appellants to complete discovery. The appellees were afforded full opportunity to complete discovery and took numerous depositions. We were not even allowed to take the parties' depositions. They were.
Now, there is a provision in the Civil Procedure Code and summary judgment proceedings for asking for additional time if you're not ready to proceed. Did you ask for such a continuance?
Yes, I filed that affidavit indicating that we needed discovery to address the issues raised in summary judgment.
And the court simply denied that? Or what happened?
I don't think there was a determination made on that. It was continued, I think, is what happened. And we filed a motion to compel discovery requiring the depositions, and that was denied.
All right.
Was any notice ever given by the other side that the court should convert this from a summary judgment motion to a court trial?
There was no request made by either party to convert it to a court trial. We moved for summary judgment based upon there being no fraud. There were no representations made to the Arnoldese upon which fraud could be based. We moved for summary judgment also arguing that the plaintiffs were not entitled to judgment as a matter of law because there was They had impermissibly collaterally attacked the judgments. They had no standing to do that. They were a stranger to those judgments. And also that the owner had final rights of redemption.
Right. But you're arguing that the trial court converted this to a court hearing, aren't you?
We're just arguing
that summary judgment was wrong for that reason.
We're arguing that summary judgment was wrong because there were material facts in question that were decided without full discovery being allowed. Those facts were really decided based upon documents that were part of the summary judgment motion, but also based upon counsel's records. The court, trial court, pursuant to acuity, without making any determinations that there was a waiver of attorney-client privilege or any other privilege, required all of the appellant's counsels to turn over all of their files. And then went through those files and referenced those files in the court's decision. The court also indicated that, the trial court, that it was not making any determination whether there's a waiver of privilege and that the court would give counsel the opportunity to address documents that were released.
Well, let's go back to the material statements of undisputed fact. What was the court using as references for undisputed facts? Was it the statement of undisputed facts in the brief from appellees, or did you submit a statement of undisputed facts or contest the facts that was submitted?
Yes. All of the above.
Okay.
We submitted statement of material facts, exhibits in support of the statement of material facts.
Because it wasn't clear from the
decision
of what the trial court was relying on. That's why I'm asking.
No, it's not.
Okay.
It's not at all clear what the trial court was relying on, other than the documents that were presented for in-camera review that were attorney-client communications, that were attorney-client thought processes, things that this court has been very protective of.
So as you stand here today, you don't know why you lost?
No, I certainly don't. We should not have lost. There were many obstacles for granting summary judgment. Certainly, if the court's going to make fraud determinations, the court's going should have heard evidence. There should have been an evidentiary hearing where, you know, if the court thought that there was a fraud perpetrated upon the court, the trial court, which would be the other trial court, and the courts that entered the confession of judgments, the court should have allowed depositions of counsel, something. The whole process was shortchanged, and as this court has cited, the trial court jumped into the jury box. That is exactly what happened here.
Wasn't the trial court really, though, just saying, in his opinion, as a matter of law, that stripping junior liens this way by using, and I don't get me wrong, but I'm going to characterize it a little bit tough, but by the landowner using a shill to strip junior liens is fraudulent. Isn't that really the bottom line?
I don't believe so.
I mean, isn't that what the court was trying to say?
I don't believe so, because throughout the pleadings that have been filed by Attorney Shaw on behalf of the Arnolds, he's raised that our intention was to strip liens. We're lien strippers. In our argument, and he filed a pleading with the court acknowledging that we could not strip liens. The Kanko and Cropland lien were the most junior of all of the liens. They required, after the Farm Pro foreclosure sale, before the redemption period expired. Most junior. The law is settled. You cannot strip more senior liens with a junior lien. There's no lien stripping going on here. at any level, really. But Arnold said that the government's lien is going to be stripped.
So the trial court was looking at the Cropland judgment itself and saying that process was fraudulent. Was that what he was
saying? Well, it would appear that so, yeah. That's, I think the trial court focused on the statute of limitations have being run on those judgments, which, you know, our response to the trial court was there was a $50 payment. The statute of limitations is a defense personal to the defendant. It's waivable. This court certainly made that determination on numerous occasions. But that, I believe you're right. I believe that's what the court is saying, that that was fraud when the judgment, confessions of judgments were obtained. He doesn't make that finding, but I think if I'm thinking what he's thinking, that's what I'm thinking. But I'm glad the court picked up on that lien stripping issue, because there is no lien stripping. No liens can be stripped at all, particularly when the owner redeems. Under the Donovan case, all liens reattach. It's as if the sale was a nullity. The government, federal government's lien will get paid if the owner's redemption is allowed, and there's no reason why it shouldn't
be. Yeah, but if the shill redeems, then there could be stripping.
Not if you're calling the Kinko and Cropland judgments the shill, because, like I said, they're the most junior of all liens. They can't strip anybody.
Okay. All right, okay.
Thank you.
The owner can always come in and make final redemption, and the owner did, and the owner did timely, because there's the redemption statutes provide that there's a 60-day extension of time if redemption is made within that 60-day window prior to the expiration of the redemption period time. And then the owner has an additional 15 days to redeem.
Hey, your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Anker, you have 10 minutes.
May it please the court. My name is Stan Anker, attorney from Rapid City. I represent Daniel Mahoney. Michelle, if you will.
I said I was going to be a little tough.
Now, first issue I want to deal with is this issue of abuse of privileged materials by this circuit court judge. Under the guise of DM&E versus security, his judge ordered appellant's attorneys to turn over their files to him for an in-camera review. And then he did not make a decision under acuity as to what was privileged and what wasn't. What he did is, in his decision, when he started to make his decision, and that's on pages toward the end of the decision, he cited to certain papers out of clients, out of the attorney's files. He said, I'm going to seal them. But that's the evidence, if you will, he used to make this decision.
That's the smoking gun of fraud?
That's what he claimed. He also...
Did he cite to anything other than that as a basis for the fraud?
Not that I'm aware of.
So all we need to do is go to that sealed envelope and it's either fraud or it isn't.
If it's something that's not privileged, if it's not thought processes of the attorney, if it's not client-attorney communications.
But maybe I didn't ask it correctly. If there's no fraud in that envelope, there's no fraud, in your opinion.
Oh, certainly. There was no fraud in the envelope. There's no fraud here. I came into this case on April 25th, 2008, at the request of another attorney to represent a third party to do a redemption. 60 days later, we were redeemed out by his client, Mr. Sharp's client, and we're done. We're out of it. We paid what the statute said we were to pay to Mike Arnoldy. When Ann Arnoldy came in and redeemed for Michael Mahoney, she paid what the statute said she was to pay to Daniel Mahoney. Then he was out. It was over. And then at that point in time, it was up to the owner to come in within the next 75 days by statute and redeem if they chose to do so. I had nothing to do with that. Mr. Mahoney had nothing to do with that at that point in time. On this issue of privilege, He used the word coached in his decision. Now, when my client took his deposition and was sent to him for review, he asked me, what do we do with this correction sheet? I researched federal rules decisions because we don't have anything in this state on it. And those federal rules decisions point out certain things that you do with those correction sheets for clarification, etc. I wrote him a letter. I pointed out those cases, and I pointed out the points of those cases that were relevant to his inquiry to me. And there's no coaching that goes on there. I did my job as an attorney. I advised my client what the law was and what he could do. But the judge said it was coaching. Absolutely ridiculous in this case. Now, let me move on. Keep in mind, if a judge has the opportunity to just rifle through files, not make a decision on what's discoverable, but then hide it over here in a sealed file and use that for his decision, that has a tremendous chilling effect on attorneys' communications with their clients. And we can't have that. You're going to have to narrow acuity to stop that kind of activity that went on in this case. Now, next issue.
We would reverse and send it back for a trial, the issue of those documents' admissibility or privilege is still out there.
Yes, but at least we'd have notice of what he says was not privileged, and we would have an opportunity to respond. In this case, there was no notice. There was no opportunity to respond. We were simply blindsided by the circuit court judge in this case.
All right. At this point, do the attorneys know what materials are in the envelope, for lack of a better word, from the other attorneys? Or do you not know what the evidence?
Okay, to answer your question, I know what he referenced from my file, which were emails and faxes between me and my client, not between me and anybody else. But I have no knowledge of what was referenced from the other attorney's files. That was never disclosed or anything. And I don't have that. I don't have a right to that information. That's between them and their client. No, I do not. I don't know what everything is in that file or in that sealed envelope. Can I go on now to the statute under consideration on whether or not these are valid judgments is 21-26-3. Requires a concise statement of what the debt is for. Concise, brief, okay? Supplies, services, something like that. That's all that's required. The judge, in essence, rewrote the statute when on page 14 of the decision, he says, no, I want it to be specific and particular. In other words, he wants it detailed. If you look at the synonym for these words, concise, particular, and specific is not a synonym of concise. They're different words. They have different meanings. They have different connotations. So the judge rewrote the statute to fit what he wanted it to say. He used the words specific in particular. I think that's a typo in the transcript. But he used those words. So he wanted a detailed description of what this was for. Now, we have invoices for several years that were attached to the complaint. So the detail was there if you just look at it. But the one document, that confession document that references those things, didn't have 5 or 6 pages of detail. And so he said that wasn't good enough.
What remedy?
Concise means concise.
What remedy do you want on this, on the requirements for the statute? Do you want us to remand this for a trial with findings so we can flesh out what the statute means, or are you asking us to rule as a matter of law that this was compliant with the statute?
Well, I'd like you to find the first or the second if possible. If not, then the other, certainly, because And I don't want a court trial with findings. I want a jury trial. I want peers to listen to what happened here and make the decision, is what I want. Now, the other thing about this statute that I found very disturbing is we've got this argument over a just debt. And the judge talked about these judgments being, or these debts being dead. Well, debts never die. If I owe you money from 20 years ago, I still owe you money from 20 years ago. Now, if I try to collect it, you may set up the statute of limitations as a defense to that, which is personal to the debtor, but I still owe the money and still a debt that's justly due. The statute requires it be a justly due debt. And debts never die, as the judge said. They only are unenforceable if the statute of limitations or some other affirmative defense is applicable. So in this case, the statute and all other, the limitation statute and all other affirmative defenses were waived by the debtor. That meant that the debt was still justly due. He bought the supplies. He used the services. He bought the product. He didn't pay for it. He owes the money. Even today, he owes the money. So to say that those debts are not justly due is wrong. And the court to say that they were dead for whatever reason is wrong, because they don't die. They become unenforceable. So under that statute, it was a concise statement of a justly due debt. It was verified. It met all the requirements of the statute. Those confessions did. And that makes them enforceable. I see I'm running out of time. Let me respond to the issue of stripping. Mahoney was the most junior lien holder. The statute requires you pay all senior lien holders. Everybody. Everybody. The Arnoldies, the government, the mortgages, everybody gets paid if Mahoney would have ended up with the property. Okay. There's no stripping at all.
Thank you, Mr. Anker. Mr. Schaub, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court. The appellants claim that they were denied due process concerning the attorney records, but they never raised that at any point at lower court. They didn't raise it during Judge Fuller's rulings. He individually sealed these documents. They didn't object at any time. Between the November hearing and the January judgment, there's 2 months' time. They never raised this claim. This court has said over 100 times before, you can't raise a new issue on appeal.
Well, but as I understand it, the documents were sealed, and then time goes by, and out comes a decision.
Well,
without counsel ever being told before the decision's rendered which documents are privileged, which ones are not privileged, and which ones I'm going to consider in making my decision. Nobody ever had notice of that, if I understand the record right.
But
is that right?
They would have had to object that lower court, and they didn't. I mean, in a recent case of State versus 15 impounded cats, the appellant tried to raise a procedural due process argument on appeal, and this court rejected it because it wasn't raised at lower court. I mean, you have to object to the procedure.
Well, I guess what I'm asking you, once the court made a decision on the merits, what could they have done to preserve an argument about not handling privileged documents?
Judge Fuller's bench ruling wasn't final. You can always ask for reconsideration. They could have filed a supplemental brief in this 2 month period of time. They never did that until the judgment is entered. His decision's not final.
Well, they have two lawyers over here that say they don't know why they lost. Do you know why you won?
Sure.
Tell me.
They were trying to use a straw man to obtain the property without paying these debts. They're talking about Mahoney saying that he's the most junior. When Mahoney redeemed, the certificate of redemption required his most junior debts to be paid ahead of anybody else's. And when Arley's attempted to redeem, Anchor objected to that, and that's in the record. He said that redemption should be denied. When Arley's filed this declaratory judgment action, they later requested the complaint to be amended to add fraud. At a April hearing, April 8th hearing, Judge Fuller granted the request and said at page 42 that the Arleys have some horrendous things to prove to a jury. Judge Fuller knew the law on summary judgment, and he knows the law on jury trials. But between the April hearing and the November hearing, two things happened. Judge Fuller looked at these attorney records, and the appellants didn't dispute Arley's statement of material facts with facts. That was an ongoing issue at the lower court. We kept saying they objected, but they didn't object with any facts. They just objected with argument. And in the November decision, Judge Fuller acknowledged that. He said, the undisputed material facts in this case show fraud.
And we would get that from the documents in the envelope, the sealed envelope?
Well, I think there's, this is documented with other things, with the letter from Fiddleman from federal prison talking about wanting to remove these liens.
What undisputed material facts show fraud?
These accounts were settled. These accounts were settled. I'll read portions of a few of them. And number 31, Smoot and Hurley contacted Warren Chemical and asked the owner, Ken Valley, if he would accept a payment to settle the accounts, to clear it off the books, cite to the record. Fiddleman and Rock Creek's response was, this is not material. They didn't dispute it with any facts. Mahoney objected, and he said, the plaintiffs failed to articulate or cite to any facts to support this conclusory statement. 32, Warren Chemical received $10,000 to settle the account. Cite to the record. Fiddleman, Rock Creek raised the same objection, and the rest of the objection didn't address whether the accounts had been settled. Mahoney made the same objection. 33, Cripplin, the other creditor, testified that he had no record of Fiddleman's account and that he settled it for $5,000. Cite to the record. Fiddleman told Cripplin that he was attempting to remove liens from his property. Cite to the record. Cripplin said he didn't have any liens. Fiddleman and Rock Creek's response was said that this was a material issue, that they didn't dispute it with any facts. 34, Cripplin was unaware a judgment had been entered on his behalf and later sold to Mahoney. Cite to the record. Fiddleman and Rock Creek's response, it was material, but they didn't cite any facts to dispute this. Mahoney had the same type of response and then said, it is not fraud to contact your creditors to settle. What this was a settlement that was transferred into a $900,000. It's a $15,000 settlement that was converted into a $900,000 judgment.
Well, you know, there's collection businesses that go around by judgments and operate exactly in this manner. What's fraudulent about taking a questionable claim?
The judgments were already,
debts. I don't mean judgments. Debts. People go out and try to collect debts all the time that are subject to defenses or.
Well, I don't think they're done by through confessed judgments that you confess one day and next day for $15,000 and then turn them in the next day to $900,000 judgments. I don't see that ever happening.
Well, they might hit a big one day and hit nothing for the next five. I mean, isn't that the nature of the business?
No, I don't think so. All I can say is that Charlie Thompson represented Cripplin at his deposition. Neither Cripplin nor the other creditor appealed Judge Fuller's decision that these confessed judgments were fraudulent. The appellants argue, when Arley's filed their brief, They say a number of facts, a number of cases. The appellants didn't reply to 27 of the 40 cases. But in particular, they didn't, Fiddleman didn't reply to the County National Bank versus Voigtgate, which is a New York case, under New York interpretation of their statute, which is nearly identical to South Dakota's. It would be ruled to not comply with their statutory requirements. The appellants claim that this Paris case versus Cook case is inapplicable. In that case, the court said it was rank fraud. And what the method of the scheme was that the owner had the property sold at a tax sale. The owner didn't want to redeem from the tax sale because if the owner redeemed, the lien stripped by the tax sale would reattach.
How a case out of New York, facts in that, how is that a material, undisputed material fact in this case? I mean, you said it all kinds of things like that in your undisputed material fact. How is that an undisputed material fact?
The argument from New York?
Yes.
Well, I guess I don't know what you're which particular one you're referring to.
Okay. The other question I wanted to get to before we get too much further is the statute of limitations defense that where trial court called the amount due dead or not appropriate. What
I believe
isn't
he was
the statute
relying
of
on the
Black's a defense.
I believe he was relying on the Black's definition of a just debt, which was cited to the court. And under Black's definition, if the debt is voidable through a statute of limitation, is not just. That's what I believe the court may have been relying upon. The appellants claim that the RLEs didn't rely upon the confessed judgments. The sheriff did. The sheriff is the quasi-agent of RLEs, and this is discussed in the Bennett v. Wilson case, and it's further discussed in a case that cites Bennett, and it is Leonard versus Western, and that case also rejects the appellant's claim that there's no standing in this matter. There's a discussion that Fiddleman didn't settle his accounts. Both creditors testified that the accounts had been settled. And the money to pay for these settlements came from the cash that Fiddleman deposited with Anchor. The appellants claim that the federal government lien will be removed. They were attempting to remove it. They were attempting to reduce it. Now on an appeal, they claim that the federal government should be protected. But the federal government had a right to redeem in this case and chose not to. The federal government, the U.S. attorney knows about this case. They could have intervened. Ann Arley was a Lima County State's attorney and had many contacts with the U.S. attorney. Ann received an award from the Department of Justice for assisting the U.S. attorney in the prosecution of it. Lima County case where the motel owner was trying to, was using his employees as slaves. But the U.S. attorney has had many contacts with Arleys and know they are above reproach, especially in light of the fact that in 2007, Arleys made an offer that would have paid the federal government's lien. Instead, in 2008, Fiddleman attempted to have this lien reduced by over $800,000. And didn't disclose to the U.S. attorney Arley's offers. The $800,000 request that he was requesting from the federal government, 2 months later, he confesses these $800,000 confessed judgments.
Is that in the undisputed statement of material fact?
I believe it is. It's documents. He requested this on PACER. Concerning my concern that The attorney records were not disclosed. Anchor testified that he was hired April 25th. If you look at his records, they don't start until May 6th. Throughout this proceeding, it appears that the appellants have overlooked or forgotten about the duty of candor. When Jeffries sought these $900,000 confessed judgments on him from the circuit court, he didn't disclose that these accounts had been settled for $15,000. When Jeffries was approached to draft this paperwork, this 11th hour confessions, he should have heeded the famous advice of Eli Hugh Root, who said, "Half the practice of a decent attorney consists of telling would-be clients that they are damned fools and they should stop." Finneman and Anderson could have immediately redeemed, but if they immediately redeemed all those liens that were stripped, reattached to the property, that's why they used the confessed judgments. That's why they used the strawman, to avoid paying all those stripped liens. When their scheme started to unravel, then they attempted to redeem as an owner, but the redemption period had expired. I don't think these Finneman and Anderson should be rewarded for this conduct, and I don't think they should be allowed to redeem. Are there any more comments of the court?
Well, I just have one. Do you agree that the court did not follow the acuity DME procedure for handling privileged documents?
I guess I have not really, quite frankly, looked at that because I believe that issue is waived because they didn't object to it at trial. Okay. I mean, we've all been attorneys, and when in a standard deal, if you don't object to it, you can't raise it on appeal. So, I mean, as far as looking at it, I mean, the judge was supposed to look at the records, but as far as whether he followed that or not, I think that is irrelevant since they didn't object. There's one other comment about attacking judgments. There's an old case, which I cited to Judge Fuller, which I failed to cite to the court, which is Minnesota Threshing and Manufacturing versus Shock. It's an 1898 case. There, the court said that judgments are final unless they're the product of fraud or collusion.
Is that a South Dakota case?
Yes, it is. Right. I'll give you the cite. Northwest, 445.
All right, thank you. All right, then we have Mr. Utzman for 5 minutes.
What I'd like to address first is what the court has talked about is debts being bought. There's factoring companies all over the nation that are buying up debt. And there's debtors all over the nation who are trying to settle debt for less than what's owed. They're, both of them are clearly allowed. Rock Creek Farms, David Finneman, Daniel Mahoney, all did things that are clearly allowed. There's old case law, but there's several cases where the courts have determined that it's appropriate and acceptable for someone to go out and make confessions of judgment for the purpose of making redemption. The debtors can do that. It can't be fraud what you're allowed to do, and there's other cases in other jurisdictions that stand for that proposition. It's not fraud to confess a judgment. It's not fraud to use that to redeem. And it more importantly, I guess it didn't even hurt the Arnolds at all. They didn't pay those monies when they made redemption. They argue in their brief that
they were hindered because the notice of redemption wasn't served on them. The statute does not require that notices of redemption be served on the purchaser. The notice of intent to redeem has to be served on the purchaser, and that happened. The certificate of redemption has to be recorded with the Register of Deeds, and that happened in both counties that the property is located in. It's also noteworthy that the state's attorney's office reviewed the certificate of redemption before the sheriff signed it. He had his counsel look at it. Mr. Schaub is arguing directly against the evidence when he's saying that money came from cash that Finneman provided. A canceled check was attached to an affidavit showing that the monies came from Rock Creek Farms checking account. Warren Anderson, the investor, indicated in that affidavit that he wanted to use Rock Creek monies because he didn't want to make an additional investment into the partnership. And it's also important when we're talking about settled debts to distinguish Rock Creek Farms' partnership from David Finneman. Partnerships are separate legal entities, separate from their partners. There's a statute right on point. The Casey family case is right on point. When Arnolds argue that the debts were settled, they're not making that distinction between David Finneman acting as an individual and Rock Creek Farms acting as a partnership. The debts weren't settled. And then Arnolds try to confuse and compound the fuzziness of the issue by saying, well, the creditors didn't object. Kenco didn't object. Krepling didn't object. Of course they didn't object. They assigned their judgments voluntarily to Daniel Mahoney. Kenco and Krepling were brought into the case by the Arnoldies. They were dismissed on a motion for summary judgment before the court entered summary judgment against Rock Creek Farms, Mahoney, and voided the judgments. So, of course, Charlie Thompson wouldn't appeal. And then the other issue I want to address is the statement that we should have filed a motion for reconsideration. The horse was out of the proverbial barn. The judge made his decision when the judge first looked at those records, when we first knew that the judge was relying on those records to make his decision and grant summary judgment. There's no procedural rule that allows a motion for reconsideration. We haven't had any trial, so we couldn't file a motion for new trial. We should have had a trial. The judge jumped into the jury box and decided material issues of fact, not really relying on the statement of facts that I can tell, but relying upon privileged attorney-client communications. The trial court may not do, and the court has stated on numerous occasions that trial courts cannot do that.
Thank you. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Mr. Anker, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Five, excuse me.
You keep better time than I do.
May it please the court again. I want to comment on a few matters that Mr. Shaw brought up. First is a motion to reconsider. There is no such animal. This court has characterized the motion to reconsider in other cases as an invitation to the trial judge to either modify or vacate his decision. But there is no legal requirement for an appeal that you file a motion to vacate or modify the decision, which is what a motion for reconsideration is, if such an animal exists, and it does not in our statutes.
Do you know what the judge relied on?
Yes, I do. I had a chance to briefly look at his decision. If you start on page 26, he starts rattling off all these documents that he's going to seal that I never saw, that I didn't know anything about till he was making his decision. And then if you go through...
So we're assuming the determination was they were not privileged, or what?
I contend they are. I didn't get an opportunity. I got no notice or an opportunity to be heard on whether or not they should be privileged or not, because I didn't know what he was doing, and I didn't have an opportunity to know that in this case. Now, if you follow his, let's say, summary of the facts immediately after page 26, it's clear that he made his decision and relied mainly on what he found in the attorney's files, those client communications, attorney-client communications that only the client can waive that privilege, and those thought processes that lawyers use when they do their job to try and say, okay, what's their next move and what do we have to do then? And that's our job. That's not fraud. That's our job, is to see what's going to happen, try and anticipate, and then to advise our clients accordingly and do the research. And that's what's in those files. But he pulls this one and says there's something wrong here. There is nothing wrong here. We just did our jobs.
How did it come about that those documents were produced? Who requested them?
The judge, at the request, I believe, of Mr. Schaub. Okay, we had a motion to compel. And in that motion to compel, I cited DM&E and Acuity and said, if you're going to do anything, at least follow that procedure. And so when the hearing came, he said he was going to follow that procedure. Maybe I shouldn't have cited it. Maybe we wouldn't be here on this issue. But I did, because that's the law. And for whatever reason, the judge felt it necessary for him to look at the files. And then he was going to follow the DM&E procedure and let us know, give us an opportunity to respond, as he said in the motions hearing transcript. Never did. He never did. And I guess because if you allege fraud, a judge feels that he can go look at the attorney's client or the files or whatever. I don't know. I really don't. But I think Mr. Schaub wanted him to look at those and wanted discovery. We didn't get to discover anything from their files. That's for certain. We didn't get to take their depositions, even though they were noticed and they didn't show up. And the judge didn't require them to show up. In this case, let me go on. You know, I've been in this business for 30 years. This is the first time that I have been verbally abused by the other side on a consistent basis. I find that to be rather unsettling. And if you read the transcripts from the lower court, when I brought that to the judge's attention, he didn't care. I want the court to be aware of that, and it's in the record. He didn't care. Also, why didn't Kenko and Kreplin appeal? They were dismissed out before the decision was made. They had no reason to appeal. Why would you appeal a decision that you weren't a part of and you weren't in the case, contrary to his statements? And finally, I was contacted April 25th. I started the redemption process May 6th. That answers his question. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anker. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock for a rules hearing.